This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by RPGNow.com, the world's leading source of PDF game products, and listeners like you. Thanks for using The Tome's Amazon store to buy your next game book. You help the show and get Amazon's prices.
Vorpal Network is the bomb. The cutting edge of geekdom. Comics, advice, D&D, movies, video games, RPGs, finding it's easy, just stay calm, VorpalNetwork.com.
This is Ethan.
Jeremy.
And this is Nathan.
From the Gamers Haven podcast, and you're listening to
The Tome.
In ancient times, that book was said to unlock the gates to another dimension, to another race of beings.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 115. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, we're going to time things just right as we build a halfling cleric and talk about game pacing. First off, I want to introduce and welcome our guest of the episode, Don Dem of the Pulp Gamer Network. Welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thank you very much. It's a pleasure and an honor.
Yeah, you and I have known each other and done things together for some time, but I don't know that you've ever been on the show before.
Nope, this is my first. I'm a Tome virgin.
Well, we'll try to be gentle then.
I'm glad.
And so Don is here joining us for the next installment of our advice episode, which I'm continuing to do every fifth episode along the way. At least I'll continue doing that as long as the feedback is positive. But before we get into who Don is and what he's doing here, I just got a few little news bits. First of all, I wanted to point everybody to a series of recent episodes from the Vorpal Network. We interviewed a bunch of designers at Gen Con 2009, and there are some interesting things in there. You can check out the show notes in our previous episode for links to shows across the network in Gamers Haven, in Fistful of Comics, and here. This is the con where they announce Dark Sun as the next setting and release information about the releases coming out in the next year. So there are some cool standards that are coming out that I kind of expected to see. And there's also some unexpected and really unique ideas that they're kind of testing the waters with, like a Ravenloft board game or a D&D Hero Quest game, which is a little off the wall for what the D&D brand normally does.
But you said Dark Sun's coming out?
Dark Sun is the next setting.
That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of people are very excited. A lot of people expected it to go Dragonlance. I put myself in that camp for a while because Dragonlance is the it's celebrating a 20th anniversary next
right,
year.
Right, so you kind of would have anticipated it might be something like that.
Yeah, but when you also see that Player's Handbook 3 comes out next year and the new power source being introduced is Psionix, then Dark Sun suddenly makes a little more sense.
It does, and we've even had people mention on some of the shows that I've been on that that's something that has not received enough attention yet. So that's good to see it, that it's coming out.
Yeah. Yep, it's on the way. And then the other big news is that Wizards of the Coast has recently launched a new community website. It's sort of Wizards' version of MySpace or Facebook. I'm honestly not sure that I need yet another social network in my life, but how can I not pay attention to it given that it's Wizards of the Coast and I do a D&D podcast? So I have a profile there. Feel free to add me as a friend. And the Tome Show has a group, so feel free to join and talk to everybody that's in the group. And I will put links to both of those in the show notes as well. Have you made it over to the new community site yet?
Myself? No. No, I have not. You know, I haven't been very good at just doing the social media that I've tried to commit to.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got the Twitter thing going on, the Facebook thing. Well, going on is probably an overstatement, but I've played with it. I like it. It's neat. I think I can see potential there. But when you get bogged down in you know, the meat space reality of life. It's kind of hard to keep up you know, all that social networking.
Well, and I was impressed in that they actually put this thing together decently well, especially after their recent attempts at similar things, and it didn't go so well.
Well, what kind of features are in it?
Well, it feels very, very much like a Facebook, MySpace sort of thing, right? You can friend people, you can send them messages, you can set up individual little forums, you can create groups and hold discussions and upload videos and pictures and all that kind of stuff.
Are there games to play to distract you?
There are not games to play at this point, which is why I sort of, I don't know, I liken it a little bit more to MySpace. It doesn't really do anything that we don't see in other social networks. It's not innovative.
But it's niche.
But it's niche, and it's at least as functional as the other social networks. You know, it doesn't fall short like certain Gleemax social networks that were attempted in the past. So it's not painful for me to pay attention to it like some other social networks are.
It seems like Gleemax was just it wasn't that long ago where they pulled the plug on it. So I guess it's kind of a surprise. Maybe they just decided to go another direction, and that was part.
Well, and part of me wonders if the whole Gleemax thing wasn't going to take. It was just taking too long. Mm-hmm. So they said, let's just pull the plug on it, but really we'll keep working on it, and then when it's actually ready to launch, we'll launch it and call it something new.
Right.
So I wonder if the people that designed the current community site are the same people who are working on Gleemax, but now they've had time to finish it and launch it when it's done.
So where's this located at?
Community.wizards.com.
Community.wizards.com.
I believe is the address. And again, I'll have links in the show notes so people can find it there. But without further ado, we're going to jump into the meat of this. And first thing we need to do is find out who the heck Don Dem is.
Who am I?
Who are you? Why are you qualified to be on here telling anybody how to do anything with their game? What the heck are you up to?
Well, I'm a media specialist, or I do media with Pulp Gamer. Myself and Derek run that operation. And so that's what I do. I've been gaming since, actually I'm kind of a late bloomer as far as gaming goes. I don't have the stories of the box set like a lot of people do. I have the story of, you know, knowing the second edition rules inside and out because I've read all the books, but never had anybody to play with until I got into college. And that's where I started to really take off, put together an organization in Clarksville, Tennessee. Reaching its climax of about 55 members, of which we ran a lot of large-scale games with a Dungeons and Dragons universe of the Guild's creation, made for some really awesome play experiences and opportunities when you have several tables all involved in the same campaign running at the same time. Let's see, and then moved on to found Pulp Gamer. And now I'm working on that. I'm doing a lot of videos now, working for Mayfair Games, did the presentations at the Gamma Trade Show for Gamma, got more involved in the Game Manufacturers Association, so found myself on the board of directors of that, and so that one's, you know, gives me a little bit of extra work to do, and I guess that's kind of a brief overview of a lot of things Don.
Cool. So you've mentioned that you are heavily involved in this thing called Pulp Gamer. And while I know that Pulp Gamer is as old as dirt in the podcasting world and was as old as dirt when I first started this show, it is possible that some listeners don't have any idea what Pulp Gamer is. Why don't you fill us in a little bit?
Well, Pulp Gamer started as a podcast, and that's shortly after iTunes adopted podcasting. I saw the potential in that, and I'm like, wow, let's do this thing. And it evolved into, we split it into several shows, and now, you know, until it finally grew into an entire network. We produce a number of the shows on the network, but we've also have a few other partners that are, you know, a part of that. Fear the Boots come on the network, the D6 Generation, Myriad Games, Game On with Cody and John. And The Game's the Thing with Ron and Veronica Blessing. So some really other notable titles out there in the podcasting arena. Ourselves, we have Pulp Gamer Out of Character, which is our morning show banter type of thing. Inside Track, which is our interview show, The Game Kennel, which is a spotlight show on board games, of which the Mayfair Games participates in that. So we take a look at a lot of their titles. And the seminars, and we just started releasing the Gen Con seminars. We were just at Gen Con with a bunch of podcasters and bloggers there, and recorded a bunch of the podcasting and media track.
That's always one of my favorite things to listen to on the network.
The seminars?
I listen to a lot of the seminars, and I listen to Out of Character. Every single one of those I'll consume.
It's Out of Character is just a fun show.
It is.
It's really a good time.
Well, and I don't have a lot of time for board gaming in my life, and so my interest in some of those things comes and goes depending on what the topic is, but Out of Character is always entertaining.
Yeah, Out of Character tends to lean a little bit more roleplay. Mm-hmm. We had 7 people stuffed in my studio last night, of which I'm editing the shows for this month of September coming up here. And the majority of them are role players, so naturally we tend to lean towards role-playing discussion. And there's more to talk about.
Yeah.
You know, honestly, there's a lot, like the topic we're going to talk about today, pacing and engagement. You know,
mm-hmm.
you don't have discussions in board games about that kind of,
yeah,
kind of thing.
Very good. Well, let's go ahead and jump into our build segment. We have our usual character building concept here, and we're going to continue our jaunt through the original Player's Handbook. Although soon we will be adding new classes and races as we continue our builds. But this time we are going to look at building a halfling cleric. And the key words that we're looking at is we want this halfling cleric to be the supreme healer, but we do want them to be fairly well protected. And then as our sort of role-playing hook, I thought it would be interesting to make this cleric a bit of an evangelist, able to get out there and tell people the good word, so to speak. It's worth noting that I'm going to be using the character builder with the D&D Insider subscription that has just been updated very recently, while Don is building with just the Player's Handbook, and or looking at this character with just the Player's Handbook. So we may be coming at it from some different perspectives. To start off with, there's this thing that you probably haven't even seen in just looking at the Player's Handbook called backgrounds.
No.
They started introducing this with the Forgotten Realms books and then expanded it more in Player's Handbook 2 and then in other books, where basically your character gets to pick a background that sort of adds to the roleplay aspect of that character. And because they have that background, they get a little boost in maybe a skill.
Okay, so this is upbringing and what you've learned.
Exactly, exactly. And I thought our halfling friend here would make a good ward of the temple, having been raised in the church, which would explain the extreme faith and desire to get out there and spread the word to other people.
Poor guy hasn't seen anything else but.
But it also has the mechanical benefit of giving him a +2 to healing as a skill,
which is where we're headed,
which ties into our supreme healer concept. Okay. Now for statistics, I guess we should talk about builds. I actually went with the devoted cleric build, which sort of focuses on the idea of standing back out of the fray and keeping everybody else buffed and healed. Which again fits into our healer concept, and since you are not meant to be up in the middle of the combat, it also sort of ties into our protected. Because nothing provides better armor class than having a slew of PCs between you and the bad guys.
Operation Meat Shield.
Exactly.
Maybe not very, very devout of me to say so.
I suppose not. Now, the obvious choice on ability scores is that you want to boost wisdom as high as possible, because everything cleric is more or less based on wisdom. You're not going to hit much of anything if you don't have that as high as possible.
Of course, having a halfling as a cleric, if we were min-maxing totally, I don't know that this would be the best class, but certainly halflings need priests as well. Just because our bonuses, of course, halflings are very well suited for roguish type.
They are.
Activity. But we have a bonus to charisma, which can be pretty handy when you're leading a flock or a congregation, so to speak.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the devoted cleric build plays off of charisma as a secondary stat pretty well. A lot of the cleric powers have a kicker, a little bonus they get when you've got a decent charisma. So you might hit with the wisdom, but the bonus hit points come from charisma or what have you. So that boost, that halfling boost to charisma actually makes a lot of sense for that. And the dex bonus, I suppose, just means that you can put a little bit lower of a stat there and it's not going to hurt anything. Or in the case that I went, I actually gave it a relatively middle-of-the-road stat. And then I'm actually getting a bonus of +2 from my dex, which is going to give me benefits to things along the route. Like keeping from getting hit.
So, what do our stats look like?
At level 1, the stats that I built are 11 strength, 11 con, 14 dex, 9 intelligence, 21 wisdom, and 19 charisma. Although, I should point out, I misspoke. I misspoke. That's the 11th level build. I built this character at first level and then at 11th level, so I'd have some feats and paragon paths to look forward to. So that wisdom is going to be a couple of points lower at first level.
All right.
It's going to be an 18 at first level. And then charisma is going to be a 16.
Excellent.
If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Skills were kind of tough because there were certain skills I wanted to go with an evangelist that I just didn't have the chance to. Now, I mean, obviously, if you're going to be a healer and you're going to be a cleric, you have to have the heal skill. That's kind of a no-brainer. And then we have a couple of other choices to make as to what skills we want to be trained in. Diplomacy made a lot of sense to me. One way to evangelize is to get out there and convince people that you're a good person and can be trusted so that they'll listen to what you have to say.
Now, here's something interesting, and I noticed this because I was thinking diplomacy too. Well, it's one of my favorite skills anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
But if we look at the suggested builds,
mm-hmm.
they list diplomacy as a suggested skill in the battle cleric, but not as the devoted cleric.
Hmm.
That struck me as odd. Do you have any thoughts on that?
That does seem odd. What else do they list as suggested for the devoted cleric?
Well, for the devoted cleric, they have, let's see, suggested skills, arcana, heal, history, and religion. For the battle cleric, it's diplomacy, heal, insight, and religion. Maybe
yeah,
it's the idea of aggressive negotiations they're talking about.
Well, you could also see the battle cleric as sort of almost being paladin-ish, so you could almost see the battle cleric as your holy warrior, your knight wading into combat and take that approach to it as well, I suppose.
Sure. Well, and I think you've also got quite a bit of charisma in the holy fighters of the East, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Although they've got, you know, there's a different take on divinity. But still that's, The Kung Fu Master, I think of as having a lot of charisma in a different way.
Sure, yeah, and that makes a lot of sense too. So, diplomacy, I think, works really well. And I find that when I'm building a character, I always sort of struggle back and forth between diplomacy and intimidate. Because in a lot of ways, they are two skills that try to accomplish the same thing from very different approaches.
It's just exactly the method in which you achieve the information.
Exactly, and I tend to find that diplomacy works better, and I don't know why. Maybe because you're supposed to be the hero, and pushing people around and scaring them just doesn't seem very heroic.
Yeah, but it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, and I it is, and I seriously, had I been given the option, you can't choose intimidate as a class skill for the cleric, but I was really thinking about ways to pick it up because part of me thinks it would be fun to be an evangelist, but be sort of a fire and brimstone evangelist. Scare people into the faith.
Right.
You know? But ultimately, it wasn't a class skill, and I had other options around the way, so I didn't choose it. I went with heal, diplomacy, and then I picked up insight as my third, figuring that having that insight into people is going to give you more opportunities to figure out how they tick.
So that's skills.
That is skills, which takes us into feats. Now, again, coming from just the player's handbook, you wouldn't notice, but there is also a new option now where you can either be a ritual caster, which you've seen, or you can be an alchemist. And there's a lot of things that might lean us towards alchemy with this kind of a character, trying to be a healer and being able to put together alchemical items and what have you. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, I tend to like ritual casting more. Maybe it's just a prejudice that I have. Part of me, I think, is tainted by older editions of alchemy, where the alchemical items were kind of cool levels 1 through 5, and as you got up higher in level, they became useless. And so I tend to continuously lead towards ritual casting when I build characters.
Well, and it's something that's kind of new in 4th edition, too, to explore.
It is. Now, for our first level feat, I'm curious where you would have gone, or where you've gone with the first level feat, because what I went with is something that's relatively recent that I'm sure you don't have.
What is that?
I went with a feat called Pacifist Healer from Divine Power, which essentially gives you a bonus to, let's see, when you use a divine power that allows the target to spend a healing surge, which a lot of your healing powers do, then the target regains additional hit points equal to D6 plus your charisma modifier. And then that goes up at 11th level and then 21st level as well to even more of a bonus. So all of your healing, or a bunch of your healing anyway, is now even better healing. But you take penalties if you ever attack somebody who's bloodied. That's the pacifist part of it.
I tend to favor, I don't know, it's just been a thing with me, and it's funny because I was just talking to Derek the other day about how some of the old feats, he regarded them as worthless, just not very popular, as the ones that boosted skills, and I always liked those. So when I look around at feats, I'm looking for things that that is kind of odd, but to max out my skills, mm-hmm. You know, like and of course one of my favorite things always to do with a character was to have you know, if I got an idea of his style and the way he moves, it tends to be more role play oriented and not as much combat oriented.
Mm-hmm.
Although, you know, obviously the combat feats are really helpful. But so I'm looking things to really make sure that, you know, if I've got a point to make and you want to avoid the fire and brimstone and come my way, you know, that would allow me to bump up.
Well, and this feat choice is definitely an area where you can, where I had a hard time making decisions here, because there's a lot of feats that I could use to protect the character. There's a lot of feats I can use, especially when once Divine Power came out, there's a lot of feats that you can use to be a better healer. And
which
then
is actually the direction you wanted to go.
Well, but then what you're talking about does a really nice, focusing on skills does a really nice job of that, hitting that keyword of evangelist, of getting out there and preaching the word.
Right.
Because that's really a skill focused thing. You're not going to see a lot of powers that help you convince people that your faith is the right faith.
And of course, you know, showing off in, you know, showing your strength and your power inside of combat gains some respect as well.
Sure. So yeah, I think there's some good choices there to be made. I tend to focus on, try to make a character particularly good at one thing, but always keep in mind what I want to do with that character as a role play. So in this one, I focus more on the healing aspect than I did anything else, which is why I went with pacifist healer. Which also adds a big role-playing aspect to it, because you have a character who's has this idea of pacifism built into them, even though all of your powers, or most of your powers, require you to attack somebody. And so I thought that would be an interesting role-playing angle. Uh-huh. And so then, should we look ahead to other future feats, or should we go ahead on to powers?
Well,
are there feats coming up that looked like something we should keep an eye on in future levels?
No, what Paragon path were you looking for in the future? Did you want to prepare for that at all?
Sure, we can look at that. What I find for most Paragon paths that's nice, though, unlike the old prestige classes of third edition, there's not a lot of prerequisites. You know, some of the older edition prestige classes, you had to plan for that prestige class well in advance. And I find that with Paragon paths, I don't have to plan for things. You know, there might be one prerequisite. There might be one skill you've got to have, or maybe even one feat you've got to have, but that's not horribly difficult to get.
I don't have much experience with the Paragon Pass, so this is new territory.
Yeah. I find that unlike 3rd edition, I don't always plan out my Paragon path ahead of time. In 3rd edition, you always had to kind of know, I'm aiming for this prestige class. With 4th edition, I find that I can get to that level and then say, okay, now I'm 11th level. Here's where I'm at. What Paragon paths are available to me? And usually because I've built the character with a certain thing in mind, then there are Paragon paths that make sense for that. Now, for the Paragon paths that we had available, there was a couple of them that made a lot of sense. The no-brainer is Compassionate Healer, which ties into our pacifist healing, you know, ultra healer character.
Is that something that's available outside of the Player's Handbook?
It's available in Divine Power.
Okay, because mm-hmm. I didn't see that. I have Angelic Avenger mm-hmm. and Divine Oracle.
And then you've also got Radiant Servant. And War Priest,
right.
No, I found that Divine Power opens up the cleric in huge, huge ways. And so the no-brainer pick for me was Compassionate Healer, which made me say, but maybe there's another pick that's would be a little bit more unique and interesting. And so I really like a different one called Holy Emissary, which really ties in, is where I bring in this evangelist concept. You know, this is somebody who's bringing the message of God to the people.
Right.
And so that's the whole concept of the Holy Emissary Paragon path. But they also get some boost to healing. And they've got these big attack actions and, you know, the trumpet of awe, the message of war, you know, these kinds of big thunderous sort of powers going on, but they've got a soft side where they've got, you know, call home the weary and the gift of life and these other powers that make a lot of sense. So I ended up going Holy Emissary with this character to sort of bring in that evangelist but stay true to the healer.
So we don't have to look ahead that hard.
Don't have to look ahead that hard. I think.
Yeah, because I remember, doing old editions, like you said, it's like with the prestige classes, mm-hmm. you kind of, that was part of the, you know, once you get more, the more involved you got in building characters, you were really paying attention to what you wanted to be when you grew up.
Absolutely. Whereas the Holy Emissary has a prerequisite of cleric. That's it.
Right.
So I don't have to do any planning. I am a cleric.
Fate is gonna guide you.
I can do that.
Right.
I find that the Paragon paths are all pretty well balanced. I feel like the prestige classes of 3rd edition, they did that a little bit to balance things out, that it was harder to get into this prestige class, so it could maybe be a little bit more powerful because you've focused on things so much to get there. Whereas the Paragon paths are fairly well balanced across the board, and so they can open them wide up and say, you pick what you think is going to fit best for your character, and it doesn't matter what, you know, where they've been in the past or whether or not you put the right ranks and the right things to get there. Figure out what's going to be make the most sense for you now and make it work.
I've got a question for you.
I've got an answer.
All right. You're looking at the character generator there.
Uh-huh.
It's got an accumulation of a lot of the different things.
Yes. All the books plus the Dragon magazines and all the kinds of stuff, yeah.
Right. I'm looking at the powers right now.
Yes.
In the Cleric Handbook. And let's see. I'm looking at... Let's just pick the level one at will prayers.
Yes.
How many... Well, and of course, they're divided in here. You have your at will prayers and your level one encounter prayers. And then your level one daily prayers. And I'm looking at roughly... Yep, exactly. Four apiece.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of choice do we have in the character generator?
For at wills, I have 8.
Okay.
So they've doubled it roughly.
But it's not like dozens.
No. And some of that they've doubled because they've in Divine Power, they introduced a new build. And so there's certain powers that are designed to fit that build. So they don't necessarily make as much sense for our character.
Have you noticed that they're, you know, being an imbalance of... imbalance is a bad word, but I mean a focus that some of the powers for some of the other classes, there seems to be more attention given to, you know, in the expansions? To
I find... No, well, because what they've done is they release... You know, they've released these power books, right? Divine Power, Martial Power, Arcane Power. And so then they spend a relatively equal amount of time with each of the classes within that power set. So, you know, Divine Power gave equal time to the Paladin and the Cleric and then some of the things from Player's Handbook 2 that use the Divine Power source.
Okay.
And so is there an imbalance? To some degree, sure, because we don't have a Primal Power book yet. So those people playing Primal-based characters don't have that book, but it's coming.
Sure.
So... No, so far I feel like all the classes have been hit pretty well, and I feel like they've even avoided a lot of the power creep that you normally see with new products. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like that the powers of Divine Power are better, but I do feel like I have more options to make my character better at what I wanted them to be, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I can have a super healer who's a better healer because I've got more options. So, the at-wills that I picked, actually, though, were all from the Player's Handbook. Anyway, I went with Sacred Flame and Pre-Shield. Pre-Shield being able to give a bit of a bonus to AC to protect myself. And Sacred Flame giving a boost of temporary hit points. Sort of tying into that healer ability. But I did do something interesting from Divine Power with Turn Undead. You have the option of not taking Turn Undead and instead taking something called Healer's Mercy. So I can use, which allows me to use my Channel Divinity power to let somebody heal themselves with a healing surge, except that I have to be weakened as a result. Like, I take that on myself.
Like you're giving up life force or like you're taking the pain from them?
It's a little bit, yeah. Only instead of it being a hit point for a hit point transfer, it's you're weakened, which just means that you do half damage until the effect goes away.
Okay.
And it's just for one turn. So for one turn, I'm a little bit weaker. I'm a little lightheaded because I took the pain away from them and they're feeling better.
Have you been in a lot of games where a cleric can go for levels and levels and levels and not encounter undead?
Well, the campaign that I'm the fourth edition campaign I'm playing right now centers around Thay building up a zombie army. So no, we run into a lot of undead.
Yeah, now, I've just seen that happen. It's handy to have turn undead.
Oh, turn undead.
It's very specific.
Yeah, it is. But what works where you can fill in the gaps is that you still have all these other channel divinity powers. You can pick up other channel divinity powers from feats or from worshiping certain gods and that kind of thing. And in fact, I did pick a feat later on tied to the god that I chose for this character that gives them another channel divinity. So I can only use one channel divinity per encounter, And if there's not an undead in that encounter, I use it on something else.
Right.
So
which
I can
gives you more flexibility.
Which gives you a lot more flexibility. Plus, go ahead.
I was just saying, I like the cleric in 4th edition is fun.
It is. The cleric is a lot of fun, and again, with divine power, you've got a lot of options, and then with all the dragon magazines, you've got even more. So there's a lot of cool things you can do with the 4th edition cleric.
And of course, you know, you're going a very, a hardcore healing path.
Yes.
But with all these combat options, you can really go very paladin-like.
You could.
And really just be a whacker.
You can.
That's a...
Well, we have gone fairly long on this discussion of the cleric. Are there any other powers you want to look at before we move on to
our next segment? No, I'm ready to move on.
All right.
Some exciting ideas and stuff to share.
So that is our cleric. I've named my version of the cleric Malira Softoe. And I've got a first level version and an 11th level version. And people have been asking as I do these if I would post them somewhere. So I'm going to see if there's a way that I can post them somewhere. Maybe I'll have it over on my the Wizards community profile over there or in the group, and people can check it out there. So,
can you export anything outside of the character generator that you can go directly to web or anything like that?
I can actually, on the laptop I've got here, I could convert it to a PDF by printing the PDF. The character builder itself won't let you export it into anything useful. But all right, we're going to take a quick break here to hear from our sponsor of the episode, RPGNow.com. And my pick for this episode is Huckstrapy from Silent Seven Games. This brings a deck of cards element to the D&D 4th edition game. A lot of what this product does is it reskins the Ranger class and adds new features to give it sort of an X-Men Gambit-style card thrower class, who can charge the cards with elemental energies and whip them at people. It also has a new Warlock Pact called the Gambler's Pact. But what this doesn't have is it doesn't have a bunch of new powers. So don't pick this book up thinking you're going to get a lot of that. Because since they just reskinned old classes, you can just tweak a few of the classes and powers that are there, and they don't have to come up with a bunch of new ones. But you do get a full Paragon Path, as well as new items, both magical and mundane, all centered around the idea of gambling and tossing cards around in action. All in all, this is a sort of product that I would pretty easily allow in my game, and production is pretty top-notch. I probably wouldn't populate my game with a bunch of this card-throwing stuff, but I wouldn't hesitate to let a player who wants to stand out take this into the game and play with it.
Get the newest releases at RPG Now. Only at RPG Now can you get the absolute latest and best releases from fantastic publishers like Palladium Books and White Wolf Publishing. There are new products every single day. Come to RPGNow.com and get them the instant they're available.
And on to the next bit of our advice episode, pacing. Now, Don, I understand that this is a bit of a specialty for you.
Well, I have a passion for this topic at the game table, and I think it really goes back to the reason I got started GMing in the first place, and that's because it's always your turn. You know, things can drag on, and so I've kind of made it my mission to really when running games is to keep everybody involved. So
okay.
Pacing is kind of how it started out. It's really, you know, as I developed, I put together a presentation for a conference that we had not too long ago here in Tucson, Arizona, and the more I developed it, the topic really kind of came down to engagement. It's because as the story develops, and this is true whether you're looking at, you know, fiction or role play or whatever, but it's a matter of keeping keeping, you know, in the case of a story, you know, the reader or the viewer, but in the case of RPGs, the player involved and engaged. And that affects the pacing, because if you're in the middle of combat, things have to move faster anyway for them to keep their interest.
Yeah, and I know the 4th edition Dungeon Master's Guide has some pretty standard guidelines in pacing certain things, like how often you should be advancing levels or what kind of encounters you should be having and when and that kind of thing. But I think you're talking about pacing in a lot broader sense.
Or in a more micro sense, depending on how you look at it. I'm just, you know, when I sit down at the table, I want to be enveloped in the story. I want to be inside of the game. And if my attention's wandering, then I'm not inside the game.
Okay.
If my players' attention are wandering, then I'm not, then I'm missing something. And it's a hard skill to master, and it's not solely on the hands of the DM either. It's something that I think there's a lot of player contracts that need to go on. There's a lot of other things that people that are playing at the table can help out with. All just rest on the DM's shoulders.
I was going to say, I think that's a lot of responsibility to give a DM. I mean, to have them be responsible for the fun of everybody at the table is pretty huge. And they're already doing all the prep work and that kind of stuff for the game, and now they have to be the hardest working person at the game as well. This adds a lot more to their table and gives them a lot to do in terms of, now I have to keep track of the monsters and the combat and the fight and the story, and I have to keep track of whether or not Jim's over there rolling his eyes or playing with his iPhone or whatever.
It's an art. It really is. And if you have the more experienced the players that you have at the table, especially if they're DMs themselves, I mean, that's the best experience. If you've all y'all work together and maybe pass the torch around, then everybody's got some, you know, that vested interest in your campaign setting that, you know, if your party does split up, for example, somebody could take on the role of the shopkeeper, you know, or NPC, just to handle some encounter. Mm-hmm. I've done that several times and seen it done and been involved in both ends. You know, in a game where it's like, oh, I want to go talk to the shopkeeper. And of course, some of that evolves too, just because, you know, they just have a real colorful shopkeeper and, you know,
yeah.
The torch gets passed around the table.
Absolutely. But, well, and I think something you'd mentioned before is also important, is that have the other players take some ownership of making sure everybody's having fun.
Yeah.
You know, as a player in a game, I will oftentimes say, okay, well, this is what I want to do with my character, but Jim over there wants to do something else. You know, what his character is aiming for could be fun for me too. And since I could have fun either way, I'm going to go and find a way to help him have a blast as well.
I'm glad you brought that up, because you really hit on a very key point too when it comes to how players can help out. And that one of those things is, you pay attention to who's in the game and who's not. If you decide that you want to go do something in game, it's pretty easy for you to grab one of the other players, or one of the other characters, or at least even hit them up for advice. If you have somebody that, especially if there's not a very strong role player, if they're new at it, mm-hmm. suck them into the game, get them involved,
yeah.
ask their character what they think of, you know, so-and-so, and get their opinion on it,
yeah.
and invite them to go to the tavern with you, that kind of thing.
Well, or, you know, every now and then, if you do have one of those side trips going on, find that player who's never engaged anything and ask them to come along with you on that what would have been a solo trip now becomes the two of you, and then you've got that connection. And that connection can then drive you through some other things and get that player more and more involved. And mechanically, the rules of D&D have always been good at encouraging you to get out there and get the other players involved, especially with 4th edition, because there's a lot of, you know, there are whole classes like the Warlord built around the idea of, well, I'm going to be a cool character when I make the other person do something awesome.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's a really easy way to say, well, I'm being awesome, but they're getting to do something as well, and that instantly gets somebody engaged in the game. Is look at those ways that your characters can synergize in a fight. To get each other built in.
Yeah, and I very commonly also, too, you know, as a player, is, you know, because I can be, you know, I can take on a pretty strong persona at times. And, if I get my moment in the spotlight, well, then it's time for me to back off and let some of the other characters, you know, get in the spotlight, which I guess is a little bit different than what you're saying. But still, it all boils down to the party working together and everybody being involved in the game.
Absolutely. Well, and you're saying pass the spotlight on, and I'm saying that sometimes you can even, instead of just passing the spotlight to somebody else, you can share it, and we can all be in the spotlight.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Or pull them into your spotlight. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of what we've talked about is engagement and pacing of the game in a sort of meta sense. Is there any advice you can give for a DM who's setting up a storyline or an adventure that's going to help them pace the elements of that adventure to help engage players? You know, is there a way of sort of spreading out the clues throughout things, or should you dump things early on and then let them fight through the dungeon to the end? Or, you know, how can you do things within a storyline to bring people in along the way?
I think a lot of it is being prepared to introduce clues at the right time. You're talking about a party, and it also kind of carries over into the whole discussion of railroading versus open sandbox type of problem, where you want the party to have a sense of direction and everybody engaged to be following up on something. But at the same time, you don't want you don't want them to be wandering around aimlessly. So I tend to use, instead of like a very explicit, they have to be here and talk to this guy to get this clue, it's more of, now NPCs are pretty mobile. You can move them around, so they're not as hard of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But be prepared to introduce different clues to the party at different times based on the direction they head. And in my book, it's cardinal sin to insist on them finding a single clue because, you know, you've got characters out there. I might build a cleric with a high skill in diplomacy, let's say. And that means that's kind of how I want to solve my problems.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm thinking along the terms of those character, that character, I might use a certain amount of interrogation or, you know, trying to get things, or you reach a diplomatic solution or whatever it is.
Or play some good cop, bad cop with this prisoner.
While another character might want to examine the crime scene, or another character might want to, use intimidate and rough somebody up that way. Gather information was huge in a lot of games that I've played in the past. So you've got to be open to allow that. And, you know, that's a different kind of engagement where it's like, just make sure the players have a vested interest in what's going on and they're allowed to pursue things and be true to their character.
And I think part of what you can do when you're preparing your storyline or your adventure is figure out what the key events in the world are, or what the key clues are, or the key stepping stones along the story that you're trying to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And then be prepared to parcel those out as needed.
Yeah.
You know, if it means that you end up passing, you end up progressing the storyline from beginning to the climax within one session, because that's what the players needed to be engaged, then you've got that prepared and you can do that. Or if it's something that stretches out over months and months and months of play because they were engaged in for a long time and they really wanted to delve into this aspect of it, and you let them delve into it and you let them go off on their tangents and do their own things, then that's fine. And when that sort of hits a lull, boom, the next step of the puzzle comes into play and they can delve into that next until slowly the story builds. I can even see getting a post-it note or a little index card and sticking it to my DM screen and saying, okay, here's parcel one, here's parcel two. These are the key events, and just sort of pulling them down as they happen, you know? And you could even do them out of order that way. Just have them all there on the different cards and say, okay, this one's happened, this one's happened, this one's happened. Or they've got that information, or they've found that.
Yeah, and I encourage you to be open and flexible with that order.
Yes.
Otherwise, you're going to be pulling your hair off, your hair out as they...
Yeah, well, if nothing else, as a player, I find that I have a lot more fun when I find creative solutions to problems.
Right.
And I kind of take the game a little bit off the rails, but keep it within the story,
mm-hmm.
you know, so that I'm not hitting everything in order, but I found a creative way to skip steps 2, 3, and 4 and jump straight to 5. And I'll come back to 2, 3, and 4 later. But I like to find creative ways to move around things and discover things in interesting ways. And so as a DM, I think people need to be prepared for that.
Yeah, and I think so when you talked about laying out, you know, having different clues, you can have a backup plan for if they didn't discover something or whatever is, an NPC can help out, or, you know, the kid on the street, the crazy mm-hmm. hermit that's mumbling, you know.
Well, and I think that by doing it that way, you can stay flexible to what the party's going to do anyway. You know, yeah. Maybe you wanted them to find out about the bandits that were hiding up in that cave. And you originally thought that they would find out by questioning people in the local tavern, but they chose instead to set up an ambush out on the road. Well, that's yeah. fine, because you can have them do the ambush, and maybe they find a letter, or they interrogate somebody, or whatever, but you know what the core thing is that needs to happen. They need to find out about that cave. So that can happen in a million different ways.
Yeah, you're almost playing a game with the party. It's like, okay, this is the way the party's going. How am I going to, you know, they're about to put their foot down. How can I put the road in front of them? And make them feel like...
that they did it all on their own.
They did it all on their own, yes. Exactly. Absolutely. That's the skill. That's what you want
to
do.
Absolutely. Well, and one of the other things I like to do to help me build that story and figure out what the main pieces are and at the same time engage the players is I like to get a little bit of background information about what they're doing with this character and who this character is that they're playing.
Yeah.
And I pull in little background bits from their character.
Yep.
You know, if their character is a dwarf from the floating mountain off in the south, then every now and then I'm going to tell rumors about what's going on down there. And I might even have them swing by that mountain at one point in time on a little tangent, or maybe somebody there knows, they happen to know because they're from there, that somebody there knows something about what it is they're trying to do. So they just need to go and get a bit of information. You know, the whole story doesn't have to always center around that background bits. And sometimes it does, but it doesn't have to always center about it, but use it. Take those backgrounds from those characters and turn them into something that plays into the story. So then it feels like the players aren't just, they're not just throwing their characters into a world that exists around them, but they're actually part of that world and affecting it and changing it as they play.
And that doesn't mean you can't use modules either. I know a lot of folks are interested in using or they like to use modules. Well, all you got to do sometimes is change a couple names and you've got mm-hmm. a custom story to a character.
Absolutely.
As a matter of fact, somebody just pulled this on me the other day. It's like, yeah, they got an adventure going on, but somehow an uncle that I didn't know about was involved, but immediately identified that as something I can latch on to with my mm-hmm. character and give him, you know, some sort of connection with it. So.
Absolutely. Yep. Good. Anything else you want to talk about in terms of pacing?
Well, I got a very specific thing that I wanted to share here.
Okay.
And it's
Does it have to do with initiative?
It has to do with initiative. Exactly.
So it's your turn for that.
Yeah. This is something that I guess has been one of those, and there's several different skills that are different things that we can talk about when it comes to these, the ways in order to keep a game moving, but it's very important, especially when it comes to combat, that everybody's involved, and you know that you may have taken a misstep, you know, or at least it's something to pay attention to, that when it comes time for somebody's turn and, you know, they've lost track of where you are in combat, that probably means it's moving too slow. And I'm going to go so far as to say that if you're still keeping your initiative with a pencil and paper, then I've got an idea for you that's going to pick that up. And this is not like an original idea that I've taken, but something that it kind of grew out of the group in Clarksville when I played there. And it spread very quickly, and now everybody in Tucson's even adopting this. But everybody's used to having table tents. Are you used to having table tents, Jeff, when you play games for your characters, like nameplates?
No, we don't normally do table tents. I've done something different as a DM, and I can talk about that after you're done. But go ahead.
I'm curious to hear what you've done. Now, we take index cards, and of course, index cards are DM's best friend. But you fold them lengthwise, and you put your character's name. And there's all sorts of reasons you can put other things on here too for different reasons, mm-hmm. but. And put your character's name on it, both front and back. Now, when it comes time for initiative, very quickly, I mean, you don't want to waste any time here. It's like, boom, something happens. You want to keep that action going. So start counting down initiative, you know, 25, 24, 23, you know, and grab those index cards from people as they hand them to you. And it'll take a session or two to train your players in order to do this. And then start laying them out in front of you in a row. So that now everybody can see that initiative order. And this is why I said put your name on the front and the back side mm-hmm. of that card, is because now everybody at the table can see where initiative is, and you're not relying on one person to, you know, to break up the excitement and figure out where they were on their notebook.
Mm-hmm.
Now you've got everybody lined up, and as they take their turn, there's other tricks you can do with this too. If somebody's not quite ready for an action, for example, or if they want to hold their action for some reason, you just push that tent out of the way and kind of hold it off to the side just mm-hmm. to kind of indicate that they're in waiting, and then you move on. But you really just have to keep that combat moving and keep it exciting. The key to this is really make it something visual. You know, put the pencil down, make sure you're doing it, you know, another way. I've also seen, since I introduced this to the Tucson group, people using something very similar, but putting those tents across the top of their GM screen.
I've heard that advice as well. I've heard of people using whiteboards in similar ways. You know, they're not moving them around as much, but you can erase and move names if necessary, and it's,
yeah,
everybody
yeah.
can keep track of it there. My system is very useful to me as a DM, but a lot less visual, I think, to the players, where I have created little half sheets of paper that I will actually fill out little stats for the players, you know, keep track of some of their skills and things, so I can roll for things for them sometimes, or at least know, oh, they have this language, so they can actually understand it, and I don't have to ask them, hey, who knows Draconic? You know, okay, well, now they all know that somebody's speaking Draconic, and it ruins some of the mystery, right? I can just look at these little cheat sheets that I have and say, okay, this is the language that they speak, and that's what they understand, and I can just tell them they're speaking gibberish, or everybody hears gibberish except Jim, who understands that they're speaking Draconic, and this is what they say. So that's the first step, is I have all the players on little half sheets, cheat sheets, with some of their information. But then the next step is that I also do that with all the monsters. I'll have little half sheets with the statistics for all the monsters, so I don't have to be flipping through books. I don't have to do any of that. I've got the stats right there. And as the monster's turn comes up, I just, you know, as the initiative goes through, I just move the sheet of paper from the front of the stack to the back of the stack, and I've got the statistics right there for the monsters when it's their turn, ready to go.
And
I've actually started printing off the half sheets in different colors, so the players are blue and the monsters are white. So if somebody's attacking a monster and they do damage, I can find the white sheet really fast in the stack and write down the hit points at the bottom in the margins, and track the hit points in the same place.
You know, something else, and this kind of goes a little bit beyond the scope of today's discussion, but we've run games with, you know, 12, 14, 24 players in them.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't run a game the same way as you would with a party of 3 to 6.
Yeah.
You'd have multiple GMs, but, you know, doing different things, like taking on the role of the monster.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot of fun. And again, it's a little bit of a sidetrack, but... But that's something that you can do too.
Absolutely. All right, so let's summarize a bit of what we talked about today. We talked about the Halfling Cleric, and we discovered that the 4th edition Cleric has a lot of things going for it in terms of variety and versatility and fun things it can do. Divine Power seems to add a lot of extra options, especially for our healer. And the Halfling makes a decent cleric because of the boost that it gets to charisma, and then you can focus some of your natural pushes towards the wisdom that you also need. We also talked about pacing, and we discussed ways to keep combat moving fast with some of our initiative tracking ideas, but we also talked about keeping the storyline engaging, bringing in different people's backgrounds, and generally just being aware of who's doing what, whether or not they're engaged and paying attention to the game, I should say, and that it's not just the DM's responsibility to make sure everybody else is having fun. If you can have fun by giving somebody else the spotlight or sharing a spotlight with them, then do that. And as a player, take some responsibility for other people enjoying the game. Anything else to add?
I think that was a very good summary.
All right, then I want to thank you Don Dem from Pulp Gamer for being on the show.
Thank you. I hope I enriched somebody's game.
I hope so, too. I'm sure you did. And people will be able to find Don over at pulpgamer.com, and I will have a link in the show notes for that. Anywhere else they can go to find you?
Well, you know, I am around on Facebook and Twitter sometimes, but that's probably the best spot.
All right. And without anything else to say then, that's been episode 115. You can email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com, see me on Twitter, visit the show's Facebook group, swing by the Wizards community page. Look, I'm not hard to get a hold of, and I'd love to hear from you, so get out there and get in touch with me. Be sure to let people know about the show with reviews on iTunes, or maybe when you go to the upcoming Worldwide D&D Game Day for the Dungeon Master Guide 2 release at your local game store, you can tell them that you're there because the Tome Show sent you, and you can get the word out. Don't forget to consider checking out the Tome's Amazon store for products discussed on the show and more. The show gets part of the proceeds, and that helps keep us on the air. And links for things mentioned in the show can be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com. This has been The Pious, episode 115, with Halfling Cleric and pacing of
The Tome.
I'm on the wall.